Can we think of the Earth itself as a living entity?
Cells are alive. A leaf is alive. A tree is alive. So is a forest a living thing? Is the whole planet alive?
I think we can think of Earth as a genuine living entity in a meaningful sense and in a scientific sense.
This week on Unexplainable, the Gaia Hypothesis. Follow Unexplainable for new episodes every Wednesday.
This is Recode Media with Peter Kafka. That is me. I'm speaking with Nick Hornby, who I'm delighted to speak with. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
I said this off air, too. I'll just say it again. I meet lots of people that I love talking to, and I meet very few of my absolute heroes, and you're one of those. So
well, it's very nice to meet you in person.
You've written many great books. High Fidelity is the one that sort of like shot through me like a bolt of electricity. Made many great movies, and we're here to talk about a project. Do we call it a movie? Do we call it a TV show?
TV show, I think.
State of the Union.
Yeah.
10-minute episodes that mostly consist of two people talking to each other before they go into a marriage counseling session.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the best you can possibly do with the pitch.
I could probably pitch it better, right? How did you pitch it?
Well, I didn't. I just started writing. I didn't know what I was writing. And I thought, oh, okay, that maybe these are good. I don't know. And I sent them to a producer friend who said, oh, write some more. And we went from there. One of the great joys of this series was because the scripts are 10 pages long, and sometimes you can hear back from people within an hour because they read the first page and they go, what, there's only another 9? And they read them all. And that happened with the cast and director and the producers.
Like, where's, I got 10 pages in, but I'm looking for the rest.
Yeah. And usually, you know, if I get sent stuff, I'd maybe read a couple of pages, like, okay, well, I'll read the rest later. But when you think, well, I can do it now, I'll read it now, and then call him now. And that was kind of what happened all the way through, which was great.
So you already told me the dumbest, most repetitive question you've gotten on this tour is, how did this come about? But here we are, because that's the kind of person I am. Was this always going to be short, sort of serialized stories, or was this originally a novel or a play or a movie, and you've cut it up?
Well, there are all kinds of bits of ideas that I have where they're tucked away somewhere, and I think I read Woody Allen saying it's when two ideas collide that things get interesting, and I'm pretty sure that I'd had the idea of the couple meeting before therapy, and I thought, oh, I wonder what you can do with that. And then I saw a couple of short form things, notably High Maintenance, the Vimeo
series. Yeah, that's great, which eventually went to HBO.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
But when it was like those 9, 10, 11 minute things, I thought, whoa, I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah.
That looks really fun.
Short stories.
Yeah, yeah. And then there was just a period in life, which if I'm only doing movie work, happens quite a lot, which is that I was waiting for a lot of people on a lot of different projects. I was waiting for a director on one and financing on another and an actress on a third. And it's like a month where I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. It's not enough time to write a book. So I thought, maybe I'll try.
You didn't want to tweet?
I didn't want to tweet. Maybe I'll try like a High Maintenance thing. And then I remembered the couple and I thought, okay, that's it. And so it was only ever going to be 10 minutes.
Yeah. And in the High Maintenance stuff, those are standalone stories. They're each a short story. It stands alone. There's a recurring character, but almost barely tangentially involved. But this is one story. You have to watch it from beginning to end to understand
it. It's a story arc. Yeah, yeah.
And so when you present it to your producing people, is the reaction, this is great, but there's no format for this. No, we don't do this anywhere.
Yes, but they liked it enough to say, well, can we have a go and see where we get with it? And I think it was a passing conversation with Sundance AMC where they said, well, we got this thing, we don't know what it is, and I shouldn't think you'd be interested. And they said straight away, oh, no, absolutely, we like the sound of that, we want to do it. And they did it, and it was pretty straightforward.
I was Googling, and at some point there was this thing, there's a headline that says this was a BBC production, or was the BBC touching it at some point, or is that just...
No, the BBC
bad industry
bought
reporting.
It.
Okay. Yeah. And bought it, yeah. But Sundance paid for it and said, go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And do they talk to you at all at some point and say, I know we talked about 10-minute episodes, but we've gone back and we don't really know what to do with this, or are they all in once they've
They never mentioned it again. All we ever talked about was how do we show it and what's the best way of showing it, but they never said rethink it.
So what's the challenge of writing in that sort of short, compressed form?
Well, first of all, it sort of got flipped on its head because the short, compressed form turned out to be a liberation in that you never get to write 10-page dialogue scenes in a movie or a TV show.
You don't get to have 10 minutes of conversation.
No.
Yeah.
And I love writing dialogue. So when I started, I thought, oh, this is great. This is like, you know, you think you're writing miniatures, but you're being given, as it were, the length of Ulysses in a conversation. So it didn't feel like that. But then the challenge is if you have a facility with dialogue, which I think I do, I mean, it probably with the negative and positive connotations of that word, that you can keep going forever. And then, you know, I get to the end of my 10 pages and I think I've got nowhere. This couple hasn't moved. They got stuck on the same loop in a conversation. I got to go back and compress it. Because if you look at them, each episode kind of has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
Something they start talking about leads them somewhere, which might take them to a bad place, and they end up slightly further back than they were the week before. So each episode is structured, and I think, obviously, you've got a story arc over the 10 episodes. So it was really making sure that the 10 minutes contained some kind of development and you didn't just get endlessly self-indulgent with the conversation.
And when you're writing this, so you have the challenge / liberation of having these 10 pages of dialogue, mm-hmm. and that's great. Are you thinking about how your audience is going to watch this and whether they're going to watch it in 10 straight sittings or they're going to watch it once a week and come back to it and you need to remind them of what they're watching?
I never thought of that stuff. I thought, I'm just going to write. I mean, because it really was like a hobby at this point.
Yeah.
It was like, I've got
a
month.
Can I do this?
And so I didn't think of any of that stuff at first. I just thought, I'm going to do it. And then maybe I won't even show it to anyone. I don't know. But then I showed it to someone and it kind of all got out of hand. And here we are.
And you guys have now shown it a couple times as a movie,
yeah,
right? At Sundance and
at Tribeca, just
this weekend. And
yeah.
Do you have a sense of how it plays if you watch it if you watch it in one run versus doing it episodically?
I mean, the thing that we were trepidatious about at Sundance, I think we have confidence in the show and the performances and Stephen, but we didn't know what it would be like to show it as a 100-minute thing. And the weird thing about Sundance was it really played as a kind of quirky 10-chapter movie. Because we cut the credits out and all that sort of thing, so it just fades to black in between each episode with a piano sting. So it sort of felt like an early Woody Allen or something
with the
like
black.
That. Yeah. So that was good. I haven't watched it episodically in the sense that I haven't made up my mind that I will watch 5 days in a row, 2 episodes a day or anything like that. I think it should work. I think probably the best way would be to watch 2 or 3 at a sitting.
Yeah, so we should explain. So you're probably listening to this in the middle of the run. You guys are doing on linear TV, on the Sundance channel, you're putting up an episode at 10 o'clock every night. And so you can see that over 10 days. And then in the afternoon, you're putting out 2 episodes.
Yeah, that's the commuting.
Online.
That's the commuting slot.
Right, the conceit is you're going to watch that on the train home.
Yeah.
Depending on what kind of train you take and what kind of receptivity you have.
or bus.
But don't do it while you're driving. And you're an omnivorous consumer of media and you create for a bunch of different forms. Have you thought about how you think people are going to consume this? I mean, if you guys are saying, look, this is for commuting, by definition, you're expecting someone to watch it on their phone or their iPad.
Yeah. And I think that it's something obviously that works visually in that form.
Because it's 2 people talking.
It's 2 people talking, and their faces are so fantastic. They're such great faces to watch, and they're such good actors. So it's not like you're going to lose a sense of scale or anything like that, because it wasn't made with that in mind, even though it's very nice.
Yeah, I had
shot.
Steven Soderbergh on, and he had co-produced this Western for Netflix, which is a name I can no longer remember, but it was great. It's seven episodes, and they're just using their full budget and horses, and I told him I'd watched a bunch of it on the plane, and he just downcast. Even though he shoots movies on iPhones, and again, he understands how he just, you can see he just didn't want to hear that.
Yeah.
But your expectation is, I'm going to watch it with earbuds on.
That is definitely one of the ways in which people would do it. I'd quite like couples to watch together, obviously.
In that uncomfortable...
Yeah. Recognizing...
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Well, have you gotten feedback from couples who've watched it and said, yeah, it's
not
it's
yet.
Too piercing?
Not yet. We did have in fact, Rosamund is friends with a marital therapist.
Rosamund Pike.
Yeah.
One of your stars.
Who came... The therapist came along. To a screening in London. And she was really interesting. She said that she'd never thought about that time and the 10 minutes before, and that, of course, a couple would be in turmoil and nervous and everything coming in, and that there would be conversations between them that would be complicated or messed up. And so it was nice, but she also told me something I'd never heard of or thought of before, that quite often or more than once she has brought the third party into the room. So if there's an affair going on,
I'm making a wincing face.
Yeah,
that sounds very un-British.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
You can tell this is a British couple, by the way, because they meet at a pub beforehand and they consume alcohol beforehand. And none of those things would happen here. Or if they did, you'd immediately start talking about that in therapy. Why did you feel it was necessary to have two pints or wine? After staying clearly away from therapy forever, I've gotten recently exposed to a lot of it. And my understanding of it is you go into a kind of dingy room that has one of these white noise machines. And all therapists' offices have sort of the same sort of dinginess, and they all have that same white noise machine. There's no pub involved.
Really?
Yeah.
That's America.
Yeah. Or maybe at least it's New York City. I would love it if I could bring a flask, but I think, honestly, they would just immediately report.
Well, I've been to various forms of therapy, but it's always like in someone's house. And I did. It was essential to the idea that they could see the office through the window of the pub. That was pretty much the only stricture on the locations, people. I think the pubs are not regarded as dens of iniquity, really, in that people do drop in and have alcohol and no one thinks anything of it.
It's very different.
Yeah.
It's very different. It was because this is 10 minutes, you can't run a commercial break here. Was there any discussion of, hey, maybe they could hoist a pint of name your beer here? Maybe there could be an ad. Maybe there could be a billboard that's visible and we could help defray the cost there.
The only conversation I remember about that came from a cast member. You've got a 50-50 guest there who said her agent had suggested that we should go to all these brewers and snack companies.
And you politely nodded and said, great idea.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she said, we can make billions. And I said, okay, off you go. But then I never heard the end of that.
Do you think this is sort of a one-off for you? Do you think you'll come back to this format, or is this only works for this story and you had that idea and you've kind of scratched that itch?
That was how I began. And then AMC, well, I don't know if it was even AMC, but anyway, we started to talk about a second season, which would not involve this couple. And that felt liberating as well. It's like, there's no way I could go back to Tom and Louise. Mm-hmm. But if you think of how many different varieties of a marriage or a relationship there are, and how many different problems you can come up with, then now we're thinking seriously about a second season.
Really?
with two different people. And I think because this one has kind of worked out and the at least the talent involved is at the very, very top level, that you've got a calling card to go to people you really want to work with. And it's not, and it's just, it's 3 weeks of your life, and if we sort the money right, then it's actually not unremunerative if we keep some rights and sell them.
Keep the rights, and you're going to only be working those 3 weeks, so you can go on to do whatever else. And if you want to drink during the filming, you can do that.
Yeah, well, Rosman and Chris had a rather nice thing where once the day's shooting finished, they got a bottle of wine from the pub and sat down at that table and then went through the next day's script. And I think they quite enjoyed
that. See, and everyone
has
this reputation that actors are coddled, you know, and, oh, I guess it's kind of true. They get to drink. It's good.
That what?
That they're coddled.
We couldn't let them drink during the day, but they had a drink in the evening. But they worked hard. I think when you send actors and actresses scripts, of course, they whip through and think, oh, I've got a nice bit there and I got a nice bit there. And their first reaction, both of them, is, whoa, I've got half of every single page. That's fantastic. But, you know, in 100 minutes, Rosamund would, or Chris would never have done a part that big in their lives, because there's nothing else apart from them. They have literally 50% of the script.
It's literally just them talking.
So even the, like a couple of the movies I've made, which were reasonably talky and had actresses in them, like An Education or Brooklyn, if you do an analysis on Final Draft, which you can do, of what percentage they get, it would be like about 31% of a script, or 28%. And on this, it's like 49. and that's over a lot of minutes.
I know people have compared this to a stage play, and then I've heard you say, no, it's not a stage play. It does, just because it is two people talking and there aren't explosions and almost very little else happens besides them talking. How is that not a stage play, or what's different about it than a stage play?
Well, for me, the way Stephen and Mike, the DOP, shot those actors and what they're given to do in terms of reaction shots and their sort of slow cogitation, I think the idea of being like 20 rows away from those faces, and it reduces it more to a radio play experience, I think, because it's all in the face.
Right, and it has to get more shouty and more projecty, and here you can have more close to a real conversation.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel like that would be real in the same way that the 10 minutes feel real to me now.
I want to talk about movies and books and television shows. We're going to take a quick break and hear from a sponsor.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday, and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Jury selection continues this week in a Manhattan courtroom where former President Donald Trump is on trial for falsifying business records. Prospective jurors were asked 42 questions aimed at determining whether they can be fair and impartial, such as, can you be fair and impartial? Have you ever been a Boogaloo boy or in Antifa? And what podcasts do you listen to? Trump's required to be present in the courtroom for this trial that could last until June. And he's been talking to reporters before he goes into the courtroom.
I should be right now in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in many other states, North Carolina, Georgia, campaigning. This is all coming from the Biden White House, because the guy can't put two sentences together. He can't campaign. They're using this in order to try and win an election.
Donald J. Trump in court this week on Today Explained, every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm still here with Nick Hornby, who's agreed to keep talking to me, which is delightful. As I mentioned, books, movies, you do screenplays for things that are not your own books, television shows. This is your first TV show?
I adapted a book for the BBC.
What was that?
Love, Nina, it was called. A rather marvellous diary that somebody wrote.
So the conventional wisdom now is that people who want to tell stories, like the stories you want to tell, that are thoughtful and kind of smallish stories, and maybe there is no explosion and probably not of a lot of existing Marvel IP, that that no longer happens in movies and that all people like you have moved to television. So how much time do you think about whether or not you want to be a TV writer or a Netflix writer or Hulu writer or Apple TV Plus writer?
I don't know if I spend much time thinking about what kind of writer I want to be, because either I have an idea for something or I don't. And if I have a TV idea, I'll write it as TV and see what happens to it. But I think you're right. I think that the hardest movies to get made now are the ones that you might need $15 million for as opposed to $150 million for, which would be, you know, the sort of Brooklyn and Education model. They are just so hard to
get made.
Those
are movies you wrote. You didn't write the book, but you wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
Very well done.
Yeah. But they are so hard to get financed, and they kind of kill you, and it takes so many years that a lot of the fun has gone by the time you get to the point of.
But you're still trying to do them, or you?
Yeah. I've got a couple that I want to try and do. I've got a couple of adaptations that I've done over the last couple of years that are waiting for the usual actor or money or director or something.
And how do you distinguish between a movie is this and a television show is that, other than the actual who's financing for it and where it's being distributed? Is there a difference in the storytelling now?
There is a difference. I think it just starts further back in your head. So when you start thinking maybe that you would like to write a television series, then even before you've had the germ of the idea, then that's the shape that you're thinking about.
That it's going to be episodic.
Episodic. Maybe it will go to a second season or a third season. And so it's not like you get any kind of category error, that it's built into your head right from the start.
Because, again, one of the tropes that you'll hear is the Game of Thrones folks will say, this is a 76-hour movie. I don't even know if they say that anymore. And of course, that there's no such thing. But say, like, it's reasonable to say that the form can change, that people can now watch something over 10 or 12 or maybe even 20 hours, but it is one long story. And there's no reason that just because we were forced to distribute things in specific ways, we can't change them now. Music used to be a certain length because the vinyl could only carry so much music.
This is what I keep thinking about, that things that we thought were givens, when you examine them, it turned out just to be technological limitations. So, you know, it's really, a book is really that shape because it's better for everybody that it's not like this.
Because you can't hold it in your hand if it's that much bigger.
Yeah, and if it's like this, then no one will pay for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, most books are conveniently 300 or 400 pages long. And as you say, it was vinyl, which was 40 minutes, and then it was CDs, which was 70 minutes. And now everything's become unmoored from its physical being. And if you'd told me 20 years ago that you'd be able to email someone a song, I'd have thought that you'd be able to email them a sandwich.
Yeah.
You know, a song was a piece of plastic or a piece of silver or something. And you think, how can you do that? But it's just now everything's floated free. And yes, if you want to make something work in your shape, then you can do that. And that's quite exciting.
Does that appeal to you?
Do
you like the idea of experimenting for experimenting's sake? Or just, look, this is how the work is going to get done and I'll go this direction?
It's an obvious idea for this shape. And you think, well, now I can do this shape. I don't have to just shove it to one side or try and force it into a shape it wasn't intended to be in. And this is a perfect example of that. I didn't know when I started it that it would ever get made or that it would ever attract any attention. And people just seem to accommodate, absorb new form quite quickly now.
You did a version of this. I loved it, and I'm going to embarrass myself because I might get the name. Was it Songbook?
Yeah.
So it was 12 essays about, or however many number of essays about this many songs. It came with a CD.
Yeah.
Because it was still back when that was a theoretical way to consume music.
McSweeney's published it.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
That's where I learned about, was it Loudon Wainwright or Rufus Wainwright?
It was Rufus.
Yeah. I love that song. So you should go dig that up. I don't know if it's in print or if you can, telling the audience they should go dig that up. You know where it is. But so you've always liked that sort of experimental thing, and it seems like you are commercially successful enough that you have the capacity to try different things.
Yeah, but I think I've been emboldened really by things becoming commercially successful that seemed to me to be commercially unpromising when I first started doing them.
What's an example?
Well, Fever Pitch. Yeah. Fever Pitch is a memoir written in the form of football match reports. And so at the time I was writing it, I thought, I don't know. I mean, a publisher paid for it in the end. And I thought, okay, maybe some Arsenal fans will read it. But it kind of transcended the form that it was in, and people didn't seem to notice that it was a memoir in the form of match reports. But it's certainly kind of quirky, or it felt quirky when I started it. But because it worked and it worked commercially, then you think, okay, it doesn't seem to matter as long as there is an accessibility in the actual stuff itself. It doesn't matter what the form is. I mean, if you started writing it all backwards or whatever, then yeah, good luck to you. But that isn't what I do.
I have a similar, I always ask successful people like yourself, if you were starting out today, what would your career path look like? Same level of talent, same level of ambition. Would you have more options, fewer options? Would you be funneled a different way?
I think that the interesting thing about books is they're still the quickest and easiest way to find like-minded souls, actually. So a good publishing house full of smart editors, they're looking for stuff the same way as everybody else. But it's a much quicker way to get to start off, because publishers will take a risk on a first-time author in the hope of investing in a career. And nobody takes a risk on a first-time author in movies. They don't think, yeah, we like this one, but the fourth screenplay, that's really going to be something. Because the movies cost $50 million to make. So you either don't get them made or you get them made. There's no sense of, we're going to print 2,000 copies, hope it does well. If it doesn't, well, the second book might.
And this assumes there are still people reading full-length books It's hard to tell now because my subway commute's changed, right? Because it used to be I saw people holding New York Times and hard copy books.
You can't see anyone doing that stuff.
Yeah, and it's hard to imagine they are, frankly. It seems like they're all playing some version of, not Angry Birds, whatever you'd be playing instead.
Yes, yeah. But books do sell and attention is drawn to books. And, you know, we can all think of, you know, someone like my friend Zadie Smith, who has come to prominence entirely in a sort of post-email digital age, and she's done fine, and she's not dumbed down. She's super smart. It's proper literary fiction, and I think her career has worked in a way that someone's career might have worked 50 years ago. And then you've got a calling card, and then you've got a chance if you want to go to Netflix to go that way. But I wouldn't start with the Netflix thing.
Yeah, I guess the other thing I notice is, been thinking a little bit about the early 90s and how everyone read a Michael Crichton book and everyone read who wrote the legal thrillers?
John Grisham book.
Yeah. And it was just assumed that lots of people read it. It didn't mean you were erudite. It was just a thing you did. And no one would ask you if you'd read the newest John Grisham book today.
No, I think that's right. Although, I mean, Harry Potter was such an extraordinary phenomenon. And there is no doubt that she got people reading, and I don't know what they've gone on to read. I don't think it stopped with Harry Potter, all those billions of books.
My kid's reading Percy Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
So there you go. So a bunch of that.
But when they're 25, like the first people to read Harry Potter are now 30-odd.
Yeah, I think there's a digital version of this with things like Wattpad, and people are kind of self-publishing and finding their own niches, and I find it very impenetrable and need someone to explain it to me.
Yeah. But meanwhile, bookshops seem to be doing reasonably okay.
You would know better than I do. You're visiting them still, right? Yeah. Or speaking at them?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
You have to work a bit harder for it, but it seems, and my publishers tell me, it's a pretty healthy commercial climate at the moment.
And they keep paying you money to do it. So.
Yeah.
Good.
Not as much as before, but yeah.
You've got a new book coming out? Or you're working on a new book?
I turned it in before I came here. So it should be this year.
Yeah. During my Googling, I saw the word Brexit connected to your book.
Well, the trouble is, if you put Brexit in anything, people say it's about Brexit. Mm-hmm. Somebody asked me if it's true that this whole series was about Brexit, because it does have the word Brexit in it.
Oh, the State of the Union.
State of the Union, because there is an argument about Brexit. My novel is a relationship between two people, a love story, which is set during the year of the referendum. So to that extent, it's Brexit.
Do you have any compulsion that during the Trump era, during the Brexit era, that things are so momentous, so extreme, that you should be creating art that talks about that or reflects it or responds to it? Or do you think, no, I'll do what I'm going to do?
Well, I think novels and books maybe are not the best way to respond because the process is slow. I can remember writers being castigated for not writing about the giants of Wall Street, and you know, this was an astonishing thing that these people were the emperors of the universe. And I was just thinking that by the time, if you'd read that piece and then written your novel and then got it published, you'd have just been in time for the first crash when they were all complete pillocks, and no one would have read your book anyway. So I think you have to be careful of that. I think it's interesting, you know, like with the Michael Wolff book, The Fire and...
Bonfire of the Venice, yeah.
No. The Fire and the Fury.
That Michael Wolff.
That Michael Wolff.
Not Tom Wolfe, sorry.
I bought that book the day it was published in England, and I was in the middle of something else and thought, well, I'll read that one next. But by the time I was ready to read that book, so much had happened with Trump that it felt like it was actually missing the point to read this one as opposed to one that might come at some point.
I think that's the peril of any of those topical books, whether it's O.J. Simpson, juror tell-alls, any of that. Even if you turn it around, I talked to someone who's doing a college admissions scandal book, and she's working very, 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 very quickly to do it, but it'll still be a year.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing with Trump is that it changes every day. I mean, that college admission scandal story is more or less over. And it might not be topical when the book's out, but it's not like there'll be 15 more college admission scandals, each of which blows the previous one out of the water, which is what's happened with Trump, basically.
I don't have a good segue for this, but I want to ask you about fandom. High Fidelity is the book that really zinged me. Several other books talk about fandom, that either the characters are obsessive fans. And I'm wondering how you think the idea of fandom has changed over time. So High Fidelity is it's a guy who loves music and loves collecting vinyl and works at a record shop. And obviously that's archaic now, but I often think about the fact that, leaving aside the record shop part of it, that for a certain kind of person, probably a male kind of person, that fandom and the work involved in fandom and trying to find the stuff and find information about the stuff was kind of part of the act, like it was core to the act.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that's probably different right now, but I don't actually know.
I think it is different. I think it's very easy to track things down incredibly quickly.
Right, it gets served right up to you.
Yeah, it's served right up to you.
But does it diminish your passion for it or how you think about yourself by identifying with it?
You know what? I really love music. And when I think how much of my time was spent trying to get 3 minutes of music or maybe 40 minutes of music, like flicking.
Physically go to the place.
Physically go to the place.
They may or may not have it.
And they might not have it. And I am loving being able to find it like straight away. It gives me more music, more bang for my buck, more music in my day. So
that's objectively good, right?
It's objectively good.
And it's objectively good for the music. Well, you can argue about the musicians and their compensation, yeah, but at least fans, the music gets out.
Yeah, and I just think it's incredibly exciting that we are in an age where every piece of recorded music ever made is available to you in a box on your desk or in your pocket. It's in your pocket. It's incredible.
But what does that do then to the people who are identifying themselves because of just not only they liked the thing, but they had to do the work to get the thing, and they knew more about the thing than you did? Again, these are your record star characters in High Fidelity, but there are other parts, other stories you tell as well.
Yeah, I think those guys have been exposed, actually.
As?
Well, it's... If you're still doing it, it's kind of a sad sack thing to do because it just shows you have nothing to do with your day. Whereas if you actually just love the stuff, then the opportunity it gives you to find out more about that stuff and to listen to more of it.
Do you think there's some impulse, though, of affiliation or trying to, like, display?
You do have to separate it off. And it's interesting. I've been... I've had a real jazz thing the last 4 or 5 years. I just wanted to listen to something that wasn't, you know, 4-4 time and verse, chorus, verse. I still do that thing as well, but the jazz thing's been interesting. But that world, first of all, you can still do that thing because so much of it hasn't been digitized.
And it's so niche too, right? It's like, I mean, it's
so
such
niche.
A niche.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
Just by saying you like jazz, you're automatically sort of at the corner of the bar.
But I subscribe to a rather brilliant and baffling blog called Jazzwax website. And every day you get an email from this guy, and every day he talks about some album or musician that you've never heard of in your life. And most days of the week, I can then get out my phone and look, and bizarrely, they're there on Spotify, you know, sometimes with less than 1,000 listeners, and you can listen to it. And I get as much of a thrill out of having found this dark little pocket of Spotify as I would have done if I'd found it in a record store.
Because you're thinking about the record store characters in particular, right, who are... They love the music, but they also love knowing about the music and telling.
Knowing about the music,
you're
yeah.
sympathetic to them, but ultimately... You think they're stunted people,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. And I think that's probably in the book.
Yeah.
Even that the music's great and the people can be really interesting and funny, but in the end you've got to find something that's going to fill up your day that isn't that stuff.
So you don't mourn the loss of sort of that hard to find, hard sought knowledge. I got this t-shirt because I went to the show. I know about this song because I followed 3 weird zines. I didn't just click a Spotify button.
I don't think that's gone. I don't think Spotify has taken care of that. I think that Spotify works best for fans and for older people. And when I look at my kids, they use Spotify in the way that I used to use the radio. You know, it's like I want this one song and then I want to hear it again. And so they, you know, they're listening to 20 songs on Spotify, which is what we did.
A lot of repetition.
Yeah.
Except we had no choice. We got the repetition because the radio repeated it for us.
But we had no choice also because we only owned, at the beginning, we owned 1 45 and then 2 45s and then 9 albums. So we were...
Yeah, that's why people of a certain age, you and I, can tell what their first album... And also what your first album was and what your 10th album was.
Which, of course that's gone, but... Now, with the body of knowledge that we built up about music, and if you're still curious about music, that sense of being able to explore anything you want without having to risk it financially. You couldn't afford to risk it financially to the extent that people are doing now. I'm really loving that. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, I've tried to lecture my kids about how difficult it was to find this sermon, and they don't care, and they're right not to care. They just want to hear whatever song
they want. Well, it was kind of crazy what... I mean, I regard Spotify as a human right for my kids. I mean, I would pay their subscription service forever because it's part of their education. But yeah, my 16-year-old, when he was talking, he's recently got into vinyl and he's got his own record player and he's buying albums. He said, "The thing I don't get, Dad, is it's like the one song." And I said, "Yeah, the 45." And he said, "Why would you buy one song?" And when I thought about it, I thought, why did we buy
one
song?
Well, there was a B-side.
Yeah, there was a B-side, which sometimes wasn't
It's what you could
best.
Get.
But yeah, one song. It's a funny thing to think of now. And which song is worth that amount of repetition? We killed them all, really, by the repetition.
Besides obscure jazz, what are you listening to?
I still look for new rock singer-songwriters, you know, country, bluesy. I love an indie band called Big Thief, who have a new album out this weekend.
Okay, and we'll go on Spotify when we're done listening.
Well, yeah, listen to Capacity, their last album, but I think they're fantastic songwriters and they feel fresh, and yeah, I've got a bit of a crush on them.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Listen to Big Thief, watch State of the Union.
Yeah.
Thanks, Nick Hornby.
That's good.
Again, what a great job I have that I get to talk to Nick Hornby, and I get to share it with you guys. Thank you for listening. Thanks also to Golda Arthur, who is my senior producer. Joel Robbie is my editor. Golda is rolling her eyes at me. Thanks to our fine sponsors who bring this show to you for free. Thanks for listening. See you soon.